From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And right now, there are 11 days left until Election Day. Let's get to our weekly political roundtable.
Here and Now.
2016.
Yes, time is running out. We have to be brisk. And joining us, Margaret Tolove, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good. And Greg Moore, former editor of the Denver Post and visiting journalism professor at the University of Colorado. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Robin. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi.
So let's start with just, you know, a sense of the week. We had bad news for Obamacare, news that premiums will shoot up for people with insurance from the exchanges who aren't getting government subsidies. Last night, Donald Trump said, hey, skip the election. Just make me president. What jumped out at each of you from the week, Margaret?
The Obamacare story was really interesting because it has a potential. It had a potential to be a real drawback for Hillary Clinton going into this final stretch of the race, particularly because some of the biggest increases appeared to be in Arizona, which is this swing state that it didn't used to be a swing state, but if she could pick it off, you know, maybe the race would be over. But at the same time, Donald Trump seemed to sort of step on that message a little bit, conflating all of his businesses, including places that don't have insurance, with one in Florida where everyone wasn't on the Obamacare exchanges, but he was acting like they were. And it was one of these sort of perfect Trump anecdotes where he had a window, but
it got carried away. It took the headline away.
Yeah.
Greg, your thoughts on the week?
You know, there's so much going on. Just sitting here reflecting, I think Clinton may be counting her chickens before they're hatched, letting that leak get out there about Biden as a potential Secretary of State. It seemed to me that she was projecting some overconfidence, and I don't think that's smart in this race.
Well, let's listen to what the candidates have been saying, and I think this gets to your point, Greg. And starting with Hillary Clinton, who was on board her campaign plane on Wednesday and said she'd reach out to Republicans if she's elected.
I certainly intend to reach out to Republicans and independents, the elected leadership of the Congress, which you mentioned. I'm going to be doing everything I can to reach out to people who didn't vote for me because I want to be the president for everybody. And I think that's going to require a lot of effort on my part to demonstrate my commitment to that.
And then here's Donald Trump in an interview with ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
If she wins, are you prepared to work with
her? I just want to make that decision at a later date. I'm not saying I'm not or I am. I just don't want to tell you today. I want to make that decision at the appropriate time. Hopefully, I won't have to make that decision. I really believe we're going to win. We're going to win Florida. We're going to win Ohio. We're going to win North Carolina. I think we're going to win Pennsylvania.
So, Greg, on the one hand, you have the polls showing, in some cases, a very big lead for Hillary Clinton, in some cases, a modest lead. And on the other hand, the election's not over yet. And in some polls, there's a tightening of the race. What do you think? And are these candidates moving in a different direction than they have before about what they think is going to happen?
You know, I just think the candidates have to answer the questions that are put to them. But the truth of the matter is that the race is tightening, and very few people thought 12-point leads were realistic here. I also think it's a bit unfair to ask Donald Trump, are you going to work with Hillary Clinton if she becomes president? Most vanquished foes don't end up in partnerships, you know, generally. I mean, Clinton and Obama were an exception, but I think it's a tight race, and I'm impressed watching the candidates down the stretch, you know, fighting for every vote, traveling incessantly, spending a lot of time in Virginia and Georgia and Florida, places where, you know, both of them really need to win.
Well, and just though we only have 11 days, and this election, though, does feel different than past elections because we always have the October surprises, but this year we have the daily surprises because this year we have WikiLeaks. So, Margaret, weigh in on that. You know, damaging emails this week showing that an aide for former President Bill Clinton was raising money for both the Clinton Foundation and for Bill Clinton by getting him these paid engagements. You know, it could be that the people who are sending these emails out, and a lot of people think it's the Russians, will strategically place a doozy next week. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, everyone is now saying the October surprise could turn into a November surprise. And all the conventional wisdom says if that happened, it would come through WikiLeaks or in connection with WikiLeaks. But there's a couple of important kind of counterpoints to consider. One is that there's been such an expansion of both online registration and early voting, both in person and by mail, that the Clinton campaign has been counting on their kind of infrastructure effort to get more of that turnout, particularly among Hispanics and African-American voters, captured early so that anything that happens in the last 2-3 days wouldn't have as much of an impact. Now, I think we need to assess each day on a day-by-day basis as secretaries of state report data. How many people actually are taking advantage of that early voting capability? But that's one element, you know. And the other element is that I think UC are tightening in the polls for a couple of reasons. Number one is the impact of that sort of flurry of groping scandals that were attached to the Donald Trump campaign kind of subsiding and people taking that into account and moving on. And at the same time, these new WikiLeaks revelations kind of pressing down on Hillary Clinton. But I think some of these revelations about the Clinton Foundation or emails or Podesta stuff probably had a bigger potential to damage back during the Democratic primary than they did in this phase of the contest.
So I know people are just really sad that there are no more debates to get really anxious about and watch. But the good news is there are some debates, just not presidential debates. And there was one last night we have to listen to a little bit of. This is Illinois Republican Senator Mark Kirk and Congresswoman and veteran Tammy Duckworth, whose mother is Thai. Her father is a former Marine. Let's listen.
My family has served this nation in uniform, going back to the Revolution. I'm a daughter of the American Revolution. I've bled for this nation. But I still want to be there in the Senate when the drums of war sound, because people are quick to sound the drums of war, and I want to be there to say, this is what it costs, this is what you're asking us to do, and if that's the case, I'll go. Families like mine are the ones that bleed first. But let's make sure the American people understand what we are engaging in, and let's hold our allies accountable, because we can't do it all.
Senator Kirk, 30 seconds to rebut.
I had forgotten that your parents came all the way from Thailand to serve George Washington.
So that's not going over well in Illinois today. Now, analysts had said that Kirk was probably going to lose anyway, but your thoughts, Greg?
You know, it's just a reflection of the coarseness of political debate in this country. I do think you have to acknowledge that, you know, Kirk is a recovering stroke victim and things of that nature. But it was a very unfortunate comment. And some people actually just sort of view that as part of a continuum with him making really, really just ribald comments at very inappropriate times.
Well,
so
she issued pictures, what, Jeremy, of her father?
Yeah,
dressed in,
you know, it's her mother that is from another
Thai,
country,
right.
That is Thai. Mm-hmm. Her father is, you know, she said, I'm a daughter of the American Revolution.
Right. But speaking of outside forces, what about, this is fascinating, Evan McMullen in Utah last weekend, Fox News host Lou Dobbs called the independent conservative presidential candidate Evan McMullen, who's emerged in Utah, you know, he's getting some votes there. Dobbs called him a globalist, Romney and Mormon mafia tool. Here's McMullen on CNN yesterday.
Vote on principle. Vote your conscience. Let's start a new conservative movement, which we've already done, I believe. But let's move that forward. It'll be a movement that will welcome all kinds of people into it. People, women, minorities, millennials, everyone.
I don't know, Margaret, if you want to call a Mormon in Utah a Mormon mafia tool. I don't think that's a good idea. But, you know, people were scoffing at him when he got in this race. He could really derail Trump from getting some electoral votes.
Right. I mean, if you look at the sort of recent polling in Utah, this is a three-way race between Evan McMullen, Donald Trump, and Hillary Clinton. Trump has had the edge, but really within the margin of error. And particularly after that most recent turn of events, it's entirely plausible that McMullen could win or could split enough of the vote to give it to Clinton, which seems really unlikely. Either way, it's a loss for Trump that could be a fatal loss if the rest of the map looks the way the rest of the map looks now, 10, 11 days
out. And it sounds like McMullen is trying to set himself up for the day after the election as kind of somebody that's going to help rebuild a new Republican Party. Greg, is that your sense? Or what do you think, you know, if Trump doesn't emerge victorious after Election Day, what is the Republican Party going to be doing?
I think it depends on what happens further down on the ballot. If they lose the Senate, I think they're going to be scrambling to figure out how to sort of reflect the will of the electorate and get some things done. If they manage to hold on to the Senate, I think we've gotten a preview from Cruz and others that they're going to continue to sort of fight and obstruct, and we may have more of the same if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency And the Republicans have control of the Senate and House.
Well, I just want to close out in the minute we have with Margaret. You started by saying that polls have tightened, and you listed various reasons. We want to point out another. Nate Silver says polls tightened because Trump picked up more third-party voters and undecideds, and those third-party voters might have come from Gary Johnson, who's lost half his support in polls over the past 2 months. So, you know, those third-party candidates, we can't forget that those people might be changing their mind now.
Yes. I mean, the third-party candidates have the potential to be spoilers. They also have the potential to completely recede. And perhaps one day in American politics, they will have the potential to actually vie for the spot themselves. But for now, it's important to remember that even though all politics is about the economy and presidential races, that a president still is in charge of foreign policy.
Yeah.
Margaret Tolov of Bloomberg News and Greg Moore, former editor of the Denver Post. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One of the hottest indie rock albums of this year is from a band called Whitney. Pitchfork says you'll find most songs to be near flawless on a small scale, working the way a great short story does. From The Guardian, quote, "It's a confident and effortless record that sounds as if it has always existed." The album is called A Light Upon the Lake. Here's a bit of the song No Matter Where We Go.
So don't you feel lonely, no matter where we go. I want to take you out. I want to travel around with you.
Joining us now are Whitney's two songwriters, Julian Ehrlich, the drummer and lead singer, and guitarist Max Kakasic. Hi, guys.
Hey, what's up?
Well, and first of all, where did Whitney come from? What does that mean?
We really actually just thought that it was a cool band name and no one had used it yet.
Really?
Yeah, and we attached like a bit of a persona to it in the beginning just to kind of like get acquainted as a songwriting duo. But yeah.
What's the persona? Who is Whitney?
There's no gender. We thought maybe he or she lived in Mississippi for some reason because that's a place that I love.
I think the persona, when there was one, was kind of like exaggerating issues of like loneliness and transition that we were going through at the time. So it was like we were feeling those kinds of things, but we kind of elevated it to a larger sense through this persona.
And are your musical styles similar on their own, or how do they come together?
Yeah, I mean, we obviously share influences, but I'm like super obsessed with Sam Cooke since like a very young age, and I don't know if Max necessarily shares that. So we just like, I don't know, we complement each other in that way.
I think a big thing is neither of us really judge music based on, like, we're interested in music from a long time ago and now and everything. We don't really, like, we're not only listening to music from the 60s and 70s or something. We're pretty open-minded.
Well, if you were to name an influence, Max, what would it be?
Actually, since you did Sam Cooke, for guitar, Steve Cropper is the man. We're kind of in that era.
Well, one of the most distinctive parts of this band is your voice, Julian. So let's listen to the beginning of the song, Golden Days. How did you decide to sing that way? When did that start?
That's just kind of the way that my higher register sounds. And it's molded since we started the band. But yeah, there's actually this like Zambian rock band called Amanaz.
A Zambian rock band?
Yeah. There's like some backing vocals on, I think they might only have one record. But yeah, on the record that we found that I like kind of fell in love with. And I guess I just recognized that my voice kind of sounds like that too.
Is it tough to do? Does it wear you out to sing like that?
No. I love it. Maybe, you know, ask me in like 5 years.
Well, let's listen to a clip of the song On My Own here, because there is a lot of sadness and romantic loss in some of these songs. Here it is.
I know it.
Now, is that based on a personal experience?
Yeah. For both of them. I mean, we both went through, like, kind of the most intense relationship, like, ups and downs, probably, like, a year before we wrote. So we were kind of, like, feeling really lonely and sad.
Yeah, that song is actually a really important one, though, too. That was, like, one of the first songs we wrote. And we wrote it in the whole day after we spent, like, walking around Chicago listening to it and kind of realizing that we wanted to work this into, like, a real project.
When you're writing, do you write the lyrics first and then figure out what the melody is going to be? Or does it happen at the same time? Or what's the process like?
Melody is way more important for me. I'll kind of just, like, sing total gibberish. But if the melody sounds right, like, if it sticks, then the lyrics just come after that.
Let's listen to the closing song of the album here. Julian, this is the song Follow, which is a song that you wrote about the passing of your grandfather.
On a night when the moon is low, on the pines, I pray your troubled mind remembers. The rain won't come again.
Julian, tell us about this one.
It was in, like, the dead of winter. I had come up with, like, that section of melody and that chord progression. I showed it to Max. And then we went up to Max's grandparents' cabin, I guess, in Wisconsin. And we, like, figured out the rest of the song. We, like, banged it out. And then one of the sadder moments in my life happened. Like, my grandfather ended up dying. And then I like flew home for the funeral and they played the song at his funeral and I lost it. It was pretty gnarly.
And is it difficult to take things that are so personal and put them into songs that people that you don't know and don't know you and don't know your grandfather are going to hear?
That's what's good about this project, in my opinion, is that we can pull off, like, you know, losing a family member, the, you know, cliche breakup thing, but we're doing it in a way that we're actually proud of, and I'm really proud of the way we did it. Yeah.
That's Julian Ehrlich and Max Kakasic from the band Whitney. They are on tour now in support of their debut album, A Light Upon the Lake. Guys, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, tonight, Wrigley Field hosts its first World Series game since 1945. The Chicago Cubs play the Cleveland Indians in Game 3 of this year's World Series, which is tied at one game apiece. This morning, around 8:30 Chicago time, I checked in with Cheryl Ray Stout, sports contributor for WBEZ, and asked her how it feels in the city.
Well, Jeremy, the bars around Wrigley are already packed with people. That's how big it is and how excited this town is. And I think it's called Blue Friday because no one's going to go to work today. That's for sure.
We've heard about people visiting their deceased relatives and things, people who were huge Cubs fans and never thought that this moment would come. Just give us a sense of the kinds of things that may be surprising that people are doing in Chicago because of this.
Well, you know what? Every person that's over 90 is being interviewed, and there's a lot of them, and they're all Cub fans. In fact, my mother-in-law lives in a nursing home, and it's a real big deal. People are weeping. You know, you're talking about cemeteries. People are decorating cemeteries. I mean, every house has got a W flag or, you know, some sort of show of their love for the Cubs.
But, of course, Chicago has two baseball teams, the White Sox and the Cubs. Are White Sox fans embracing the Cubs right now for the World Series, or how's that working out?
White Sox fans are wearing Cleveland Indian jerseys.
Really?
Yes. Some of them, I should say. Some of them are. It depends on where you go. The older fans, they will never cheer for the Cubs. The younger White Sox fans, they're embracing it because they like to have a party. So, you know, enjoy the party. And the fact that they already have their championship, they feel like they have some ownership with that. And an interesting thing is some like ESPN and even the Chicago Tribune didn't even recognize the White Sox when they're talking about baseball championships here. So there's a little bit of an angst towards the Cubs as far as Sox fans.
You know, one of the terms that people outside Chicago are hearing for the first time right now is fly the W. And this is this flag, this W flag, which I guess is showing up all over Chicago. Can you just explain that to us? Why a W?
Well, if you look at Wrigley Field, in the outfield, there is a pole that they have. And after every game, they either put, if it's a win, it's a W. If it's a loss, it's an L. So the big deal is that they capitalize on that with the hashtag Fly the W. And so people have bought those flags. You could get them in any store now. And they are, or instead of having a Cub flag, they have the Fly the W flag.
Hmm. Are there going to be scalpers out in the street for a game like this, or is it just impossible to get tickets at this point?
Well, you know, the prices keep varying as far as that goes. But yes, there'll be scalpers. But with all the police activity and everything going on there, I don't think that they're going to, you know, be very close to the ballpark. They'll probably be in the perimeter of Wrigleyville.
What are the tickets going for?
At least 2,000 for standing room only.
Wow.
Standing room
only. Wow, that is amazing. So, Cheryl, you have to be kind of a straight journalist as well as,
yes,
you know, being a lifelong Chicagoan. But what do you think each team needs to do tonight to win this game?
Well, the one thing is Kyle Hendricks has to be Kyle Hendricks on the mound for the Cubs because he's a Cy Young candidate. He doesn't show a lot of emotions. He's very, very controlled. And the Cubs hitters have got to attack Josh Tomlin right away. He was their fifth starter, but he's pitched very well since the Indians had two starters go down. So he has to control, don't walk anybody, because the Cubs will take a lot of pitches. And if he can keep the ball in the strike zone, he'll have success. The other thing is the Indians are going to try to run on the Cubs, but the one thing is that Joe Maddon is done. He's gone to the rookie catcher, Wilson Contreras, because that kid can throw out base runners.
Well, Cheryl Reistout, a sports contributor for WBEZ. It's going to be an exciting night in Chicago. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping you make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at Blue Apron. blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
Mike Pence got a scare last night. By now, you've probably heard that the plane carrying the Republican vice presidential candidate skidded off the runway in heavy rain at LaGuardia Airport in New York. But by an act of grace and science, all 48 people were uninjured because the runaway plane was stopped by something called an arrestor bed. It's weird. The campaign was also shaken up a couple weeks ago when a previous pilot was fired for being charged with intentionally hitting a man with his car. But what happened last night? Chris Oswald is Vice President of Safety and Regulatory Affairs at the Airports Council International. He joins us by Skype. So, Chris, an arrestor bed, what is that?
So an arrestor bed, or we use acronyms in aviation all the time, Engineered Materials Arresting System, EMAS. It's a system of concrete blocks. They're specially engineered to be crushable so that when you get an aircraft that is not able to brake on the standard length of runway, it slows them down. Think of it as kind of a runaway truck ramp for aircraft.
Well, now we realize that watching the coverage last night, it was kind of interesting that all the anchors, because their reporters were coming off the plane and doing this live coverage of what had happened, and many of them were showing the footage of the runway and saying, wow, what a hard landing that must have been. It tore up the runway. But now we realize this was that crushable concrete.
Exactly. It's designed to do that. So it can slow the aircraft down as the landing gear comes through the system. Really, it goes back all the way to 1999 out in John F. Kennedy. Mm-hmm. And that system's claimed a couple of saves already. I'd love to say gently, but without damaging the aircraft or causing injuries to passengers, as we saw certainly with Mr. Pence's aircraft.
Do all major airports have this?
Not all major airports do. Those that are not able to provide they call them runway safety areas, a full 1,000-foot runway safety area beyond the end of the runway, do use EMAS as a mitigation. Usually that 1,000 feet is enough to stop an aircraft without needing to resort to crushable concrete. But again, you get to a facility like LaGuardia, which is built back in the 1930s on a very, very constrained site. no easy way to provide that full 1,000 feet with where the Grand Central Parkway is. You have to rely on these types of technology at airports around the country that have that sort of condition.
Those of us from New York affectionately refer to LaGuardia as flying on and off an airship carrier because it's that small when you fly
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely.
But the Port Authority in New York and New Jersey said the plane overshot the runway. Do we know how often this technology has prevented someone going off into, say, a body of water?
Yeah, in the United States, FAA's reported 11 saves through yesterday, I believe, and so I think we're on our 12th now. These systems are actually being deployed worldwide now as well. Canadian airports beginning to deploy them in Asia as well, in Europe. So I think, again, it's a technology that's proven itself and has certainly, not just in the case of Governor Pence's aircraft, but there's a very, very high-profile save in Charleston, West Virginia. It was a commuter aircraft regional jet that probably would have ended up in serious injuries or fatalities for the 30-some people that were on that plane. So very, very significant technology that make their facilities safer.
Chris Oswald, Vice President of Safety and Regulatory Affairs at the Airports Council International. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Like an armadillo covered with steel plates. That's the way New York Times photographer Brian Denton described the ISIS car bomb that lumbered toward the Iraqi troops he was embedded with on October 20th, part of the push towards Mosul. This was the fourth Mad Max-like car bomb they'd encountered in what sounds like a terrible real-life video game in the desert. Brian writes, someone shouted, car bomb. He ran for cover, but it was too late. He and some of the Iraqis were hit. Brian in the wrist, and he's a photographer, but he was lucky. An inch either way, he would have lost his hand. The Iraqis were also lucky, their wounds not life-threatening. There's a link to Brian's powerful story and pictures at hereandnow.org as we welcome him on Skype from his home in Beirut, Lebanon. And Brian, you were traveling with elite Iraqi counterterrorism forces from the Kurdish capital, Erbil, heading towards Mosul, the goal to clear a town of ISIS fighters. You were in one of the armored Humvees. Start there.
We had gotten in the vehicle when it was midway in the column, and then it quickly, within an hour, sort of worked its way up to the front. And by the time we understood where we were, it was too dangerous to get outside and try to find another car or walk back to the lines. So we were sort of stuck with the shelter that we had, essentially.
Such as it was. I mean, it's the descriptions are incredible. You're lumbering along, and the entire time you're being shot at. The windows are cracking, and these huge, thick-plated Humvees, because you're being shot at by snipers. There's mortar fire coming in. The commander, an Iraqi, is pointing out, and this is such a chilling line, fleeting shadows of Islamic fighters moving among points of concealment. It just feels like this terrible real life video game.
Yeah, I think what was the most surreal about it is that, I mean, it's as a photographer when you're working, when you're covering the front lines, I try to be as efficient as I can about the way that I work, and I usually try to calculate my risks. Am I going to get a lot of good, interesting journalism out of this if I'm going to be taking this risk? And frankly, like sitting in the back of an MRAP all day wasn't exactly what I had hoped, before I got wounded and before the day, had really, really started. I was thinking, wow, this is actually not that useful journalistically because I'm just sitting here.
Well, I have to disagree
in the back of a truck.
I have to disagree with you, Brian, because hearing this description of what it's like just to move towards a town, your tire is shot out. So now, if you were limping before, you're really kind of thud. You can even almost hear this flat tire as this convoy is limping along, again, fired on the whole time. And then you paint descriptions of these car bombs that come at you. Again, all I can think of is Mad Max. There's one, it's got steel plates painted this dull green and coyote brown. It's careening clumsily into a field where it hits a ditch and flips over and lays there like a turtle on its back, as you describe it. This is a car bomb.
Absolutely, no, and they're very clever about how they stage them. They stage them at points where they know that they don't have a very long run to get to the convoy, because the longer that they're exposed, the more likely it is that they're going to be hit by an airstrike that's called in. Usually, every time one appeared, there was maybe a 15 to 25 second window that you had before it was upon you.
Yeah.
It was incredibly nerve-wracking, and because, you know, you just didn't know what was coming around the next corner, essentially. No.
That was the flip turtle is the first car bomb. The second one's a pickup that comes out from between buildings. Again, it's stacked with painted makeshift armor. It gets picked off by the Iraqi tank that's accompanying you. I mean, there's four total. It's just incredible. But then there's also the trenches that ISIS has dug. And so you've got bulldozers that are traveling with you trying to either fill in a trench or dig a trench. It's incredibly hard business just traveling.
It is, absolutely. And, you know, I think one of the most dangerous jobs probably, you know, in the Iraqi forces that are pushing, you know, along their lines of advance is probably the bulldozer driver, because essentially you have no means of defending yourself. I've come to admire the courage of the bulldozer drivers probably more than anybody on the battlefield.
Right. The ordnance removal technicians, you know, coordinating with the bulldozer. Here's one sentence. They had just cleared four big IEDs, and you were waiting for them to clear those while Islamic State fighters were shooting at the convoy as it moved along. Look, couple questions. What do you think your experience says about this effort in general? It's just stunning to see how hard it is just to move towards a confrontation with someone. This is just the travel. This isn't even trying to take the village.
These battles are, you know, are incredibly difficult to fight tactically, especially once you get into the city. You know, if ISIS decides that they want to make a really, you know, hard stand inside the city, and it, you know, we could see this stretch into, you know, into December and even into January or beyond.
Well, you, of course, had your point of view of the flipped turtle, but so did ISIS, and they actually released video that they took. We'll post it at herenow.org. But let's listen to a little of it. We'll let it play under. What are we seeing here from the ISIS point of view? This is just before the first car bomb. Have you seen it, Brian?
I have seen it, yes. I mean, it's essentially it's sort of video from a distance of a convoy moving through the desert. And it was pretty surreal for me to watch because I'm actually in the sort of tan MRAP in that video. Yeah. And so sort of it's sort of strange to find yourself, like, you know, being able to place yourself within one of their propaganda videos, because for somebody like me, that usually means you're having your head cut off.
Oh, please. Well, you know, I have to ask you about that. You about that, because this is very dangerous work, as you well know. And it's sort of gallows humor there, I know, because photographer Tim Hetherington was lost in Libya. Tyler, your colleague at the Times, was kidnapped. Tyler Hicks, taken hostage for a while. Your thoughts on the danger here?
I mean, for me, I've never thought of myself as a war photographer. For me, you know, my passion in my career has been covering the Middle East and especially focusing on this sort of pivotal moment that we've found ourselves in historically, you know, in the aftermath of the Arab Spring and all of the, you know, changes that are taking place. And so a lot of my coverage has centered on stuff happening behind the front lines and how these societies are changing. But I also believe that it is important at times to take calculated risks and to show people at home what war is actually like, especially in this day and age when the U.S. is, you know, sort of peripherally involved, you know, in these conflicts, and, you know, the U.S. population doesn't necessarily have a whole lot of access to, you know, the extent of our involvement. So I think it's really important to be able to, you know, shine a light on that in some ways. You know, what happened to Tim Hetherington, to Chris Hondros, who was also a friend in Libya, and, you know, Tyler and Lindsay being captured and taken and held while they were there. Additionally, you know, I was close friends with Peter Kasig, who was, you know, held hostage by ISIS and ultimately murdered.
Right.
You know, these things have all weighed heavily on me. And so I've, you know, I'm not one to linger at the front lines. You know, I try to be efficient in my reporting there and leave as soon as I have enough. You know, I also think that that there's not that much information that you can glean from somebody, you know, from a picture of somebody firing a weapon. I think that those pictures can be important, but I also think that it's important to be just behind the front lines. You know, I was actually it was a bit of a mixed set of emotions for me. On the one hand, I'm happy to be, all right and to be home with my family. But at the same time, I wish I was still there covering it, because my plan had been to spend maybe a day or two covering sort of the frontline operations. But then I had really wanted to, sort of shift into, coverage of what's happening with the internally displaced from Mosul. What's happening, what do these towns look like that have been recaptured? Like, what is, what did ISIS leave behind? Like, what can we understand from what they left behind about who they were or who they are and what they want and how they were living? I'm a little bit, not regretful, but I wish I'd been able to sort of stay and cover some of that as well.
Go beyond the bang bang.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, photographer Brian Denton, will link you to his terrific story and pictures and the ISIS video at hereandnow.org. Brian, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The series finale of the new FX show Atlanta is coming up next Tuesday. The show stars Donald Glover, who wrote in the late 2000s for 30 Rock and then starred in NBC's Community for 5 seasons. He's also a rapper. His stage name is Childish Gambino. His song 3005 has more than 120 million plays on Spotify alone. We all just ticking time bombs. Got a Lambo like LeBron's mom. And no matter where all of my friends go, yeah. Emily, fam, and Lorenzo, yeah. All of them people my kinfolk. At least I think so. Can't tell. Cause when them checks clear, they're not here. Cause they don't care. It's kinda sad. Joining us to talk about Atlanta is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
What up?
Well, and let's hear.
I thought that was appropriate given the music we just heard.
Absolutely. And let's hear a clip from the actual show where Glover plays Earn, a young black dad. Here he is talking with a friend played by Keith Stanfield. And Stanfield's character talked him into a long-term investment opportunity that's going to take a lot longer to reap results than Earn thought.
My daughter needed that money, okay? Not in September, but today. Okay, see, I'm poor, Darius. Okay, and poor people don't have time for investments because poor people are too busy trying not to be poor. Okay, I need to eat today, not in September.
Right, I asked you at the pawn shop if you needed the money to take the money. You said you wanted more money, so I got you more money.
Now, you can't tell from this scene exactly, but this is technically a comedy, right?
Yeah, it is a comedy, and there's parts of Atlanta that are funnier than what we just heard. Hmm. But what's interesting about Atlanta, it's basically about these three guys, and Donald Glover is one of the characters. His name is Earn Marks, and he dropped out of Princeton, and he's searching for his way forward in life. His cousin is an up-and-coming rapper named Paperboy, and so he's trying to convince his cousin to let him be his manager. And then his cousin has a friend, Darius, who's kind of off the wall and sort of their version of Kramer from Seinfeld, if you can understand that analogy. And as they navigate the worlds of sort of show business and the music business and just life in general, they bounce into and off of all these interesting situations. And some of it is about race, and some of it, a lot of it, is actually about class.
Well, here's one of the situations you're talking about. This is from the show's most recent episode. And in this, Earn is at a party at a home owned by a rich white man who knows a lot about black culture.
You've never been to Africa?
No.
You gotta go. Man, it's your motherland. What are you thinking? Missing out. What are you?
Huh? What?
Where are your ancestors from? Congo? Ivory Coast?
I don't know. This spooky thing called slavery happened and my entire ethnic identity was erased.
So. Hey, Eric, how does this show do you think, at talking about the black experience in America? Because I know that's something that you pay a lot of attention to as you watch all kinds of shows.
Well, I think the message of this show is that there isn't one black experience in America. There's many different ones, and negotiating that is an important part of finding yourself as a black person in America. You know, this was from an episode where, he has a girlfriend and they have a child together, and she has sort of convinced him to pretend that they're married so they can go to this party that's being hosted by this wealthy black woman and her white husband And once they get there, they realize that all the people there are pretty solidly middle class, upper middle class even. And the black woman in particular, she has views that would be viewed as racist if she was white. And it's just one uncomfortable, you know, interaction after another. You know, Erin winds up with her white husband who is trying to discover black culture and, you know, has all this poetry he's written that's awful and these paintings that he's painted that are terrible. And the girlfriend goes off with the wife and the wife admits that she mostly married this guy for his money. And she tolerates this weird sort of objectification or fetishization of black culture that he has. You know, this is a show that's saying a lot with a little, and it's also managing to be quite funny. I mean, all the stuff we're talking about isn't necessarily all that funny, but when you watch the episodes, there's a lot of humor there, too.
It's also another big moment for Donald Glover, who, as we talked about, was a writer for 30 Rock and has been a rapper, Childish Gambino, and also is going to play a young Lando Calrissian in the upcoming Star Wars movies.
Yeah.
He is really on fire right now.
Yeah, well, this is a guy also that you get the sense he's a great creative spirit. And I think in a way, he's been trying to figure out where he fits and how he can best utilize his skills. And so, you know, Atlanta has been perfect for him. And he's somebody who's worn a lot of hats. I mean, he's done everything from being executive producer to oversee the music to even directing an episode or two. He's been able to sort of show the show business world what he's capable of. And so I think we're going to see a lot more from him now that Hollywood is aware of just how good he can be when he gets the resources and the time to create something special.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans talking with us about Donald Glover and his new show, Atlanta, which is on FX. Eric, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.